Do you want to know what a porcupine smells like? Now, in the early days of the new year, already eager for spring, I'm reminded of the time a few years back when I snowshoed through the Canadian woods. I'm not really an outdoorsy person, but that day, teetering on snowshoes with a ski pole to steady myself, off to track coyotes, I felt about as intrepid as I ever will. We were only about 10 minutes from town, but you would never know that. The only sounds were those of nature, bird calls, and the roar of the rapids where the ice on the river had started to melt. Canada is one of the largest countries in the world, yet 80% of the population lives within 100 kilometers of the US border, leaving almost 9 million square kilometers virtually empty. It is that sense of vast openness and isolation, the bush, that forms a large part of Canadian identity, and even the most urbane resident of Toronto or Montreal never feels far from the woods. Canoeing, hiking, and camping are second nature to most Canadians. It was March. We were coming off an extremely harsh winter that saw the temperature plummet to minus 30. But that day, it was just about zero, with fresh, soft snow on the ground, which made it easier for both snowshoeing and spotting animal tracks. Generally, I like my nature seen through the safety of a TV screen, and as I followed the coyote tracks, I wondered if the animal was nearby, and I wished I had David Attenborough to hand to narrate me out of this. My friend Hillary patiently waited for me to catch up, which I did with tremendous effort, as walking in snowshoes is much harder than it looks. Coyotes are extremely intelligent, and they've earned the name Wiley, she told me. The Roadrunner cartoons have done them a massive disservice. You should have been here last week. One crept right up on me, and I didn't hear a thing. I looked back at the trail. It was eerily peaceful. I remembered I hadn't told anyone where I was going, and the headline, Irishman Eaten by Wolves, filled my mind. The tracks were in a straight line with a perfect 90-degree turn. A domestic dog will traipse all over, but a coyote doesn't waste energy, explained Hillary. Oh, look, she said, suddenly more excited. A beaver! Sure enough, down by the river was Canada's national animal, beloved by wildlife enthusiasts, but despised by landowners for the damage they do to trees. It had just felled a birch. It watched us for a little time before slipping off the ice and into the water. All around was evidence of wildlife. There were little arrows in the snow made by wild turkeys, hoof prints from deer and paw marks from a coyote. There was blood in the snow from where one had killed a rabbit. The wild dog proved elusive, prompting Hillary to suggest using her predator caller, a device that mimics the sound of animals in various states of anxiety. A frightened rabbit's scream filled the air. No response. So Hillary changed the setting to fawn in distress. Still no sign of the coyote, but I had nightmares about Bambi for weeks. On the drive back to town, I noticed a bird's head in the back of Hillary's car. Oh, that, she said blandly. I hit a partridge the other day. I chopped off his head for my skull collection. Skull collection? Her apartment looked like the back room of the Natural History Museum. There were the skulls of bats, birds, turtles, porcupines, and her most prized possession, the skull of a 300-pound bear. Hillary told me the cleaning process. I tie up the head outside, let the bugs pick a clean. I bleach it to remove any leftover germs, then dip it in hydrogen peroxide to whiten it. Sometimes I have to glue the teeth back in. I will never look at model glue the same way. Hillary was getting more excited. Look, bears have 42 teeth, but this old guy only had 37, and you can see where his canine got infected and it went right into the jaw. There was also a mouse's skull. Usually I wouldn't bother to keep such a tiny one, but you can see the perfect puncture wound from where the fox's tooth went in. I cast a worried glance at her two cats. Do you think it's an odd hobby? I asked her. Probably. I just find it an interesting way to learn about how animals live. Their teeth are broken, you can see cavities. At least it isn't as weird as taxidermy, she said, rolling her eyes. I don't stuff the things. Bones seem less creepy somehow. In the world of handling animal carcasses, skull collectors obviously regard taxidermists as out there, the same way that Trekkies might dismiss Babylon 5 fans as losers. It occurred to me it had been a death-filled afternoon. Not really, said Hillary. The world is hibernating at the moment. And when spring comes, there'll be young to care for. The porcupine didn't come out of her den because she's pregnant and far more cautious about being out. The porcupine's den, by the way, smelled of old socks dipped in cat pee with a gamey undertone. I won't be in a rush to smell it again. But if, like Thoreau, I went into the woods to live deliberately, I came out of them a little more respectful of the seeming peace that they offer.
All too quickly, the Christmas holidays were over, and I was back at school again, away from home. By the start of the second term, I knew all too well the daily rituals of boarding school, as well as the longing, loneliness, and wishing that went with it. I woke every morning to the sound of bells being rung up and down the dormitory aisles. After breakfast, we'd shiver on the avenue walk to our classrooms, the icy crunch of gravel underfoot like gunshot in the eerie stillness of the morning. At night we'd gather in the refectory, deafening ourselves as we dragged our 200 stools from under the tables to sit as one for dinner. At bedtime in my little cubicle, even as I tried to damp down the waves of homesickness, a terrible tide of longing would sweep me along towards a level of self-awareness and knowledge that had me wondering about the quality of time and the alien nature of the night sky. It was my aunts who took me to Cork first to have me fitted out in a brown gym slip. They paid for the blazer with the school crest on it too. They judged the effect, turning me around to study the cut of the uniform on my 12-year-old frame. They tightened the sash and fixed the pleats, and I felt like an experiment as they lavished me with the best of everything, even treating me to tea in the Walter Raleigh Hotel in Youghal on our way home. I arrived in that evening laden down with a great pile of parcels and bags. Of course, my younger sisters were green with envy as I paraded around in my new uniform and gabardine coat. All belted up in the brown ensemble, I pulled the belt through the buckle, placed the school beret at a jaunty angle atop my head and swaggered around like Marlene Dietrich playing Mata Hari. As I counted the days until I'd be driven to my new school some 60 miles away, I sewed special name tags onto everything. The pair of new sheets, the two new linen napkins, two new blankets, a Foxford rug and a little grey game skirt with a swish that I could see myself wearing when I went out with my first ever hockey stick onto the playing pitch. I'd be saying goodbye to the rough and tumble of camogie matches in the Gaeltacht. It would be a life of hockey games, sports mistresses and midnight feasts, just like in Enid Blyton's Mallory Towers or St. Clair's. I started thinking about tuck boxes, and I wondered if they'd have a sports hall, a belfry, or a matron for when I was sent to the infirmary. My initials were carved into my own cutlery set, and I got a heavy silver table ring for my new linen napkins. And my Auntie Sheila gave me a great American suitcase with fading labels pasted on its sides, mementos of her exotic honeymoon cruise to New York and other trips to Corfu and Rome. As I packed the case with 4 new vests, 8 pants, 6 brown knee socks, the school tie, the new dressing gown, slippers and a new toilet bag, I felt my own journey to faraway Cork and boarding school was well on a par with such travels. My life would be spectacular, worth writing about in a novel, like Jane Eyre, The Little Madeline, or Anne of Green Gables. And in the end, it was as good as any Enid Blyton novel. We had Miss Walton for English, Mr. O'Driscoll for history, tobogganing during the snow, and a head girl to lead us in grace before meals. But nothing could compare with being at home for Christmas. I sat at the kitchen table, watching my mother shake the flour loose and kneading the dough as she made brown bread. A knot in my stomach as I felt the days slip away. I tiptoed around in case it was a dream. My sisters, in turn, tiptoed around me. In a way, I was like a stranger in their midst. And in the blink of an eye, I was back, suspended once again in that strange universe, adrift at night in a sea of echoing silence. Only on Sunday afternoon, each week at exactly 3 o'clock, would I stand on the convent landing and focus all my attention on the public payphone. Its sudden explosion into life was terrifying, but I'd pick up the receiver and hear my mother's voice. Then a tightness would grip my chest. I'd lose the ability to speak, find it hard to swallow, and tears would stream out of my eyes as I gave vent to the great river of loss that my 12-year-old self could hardly understand.
On a fine autumn day in 1954, my father and eldest brother Liam were striding past the GPO when a street photographer clicked his camera. Liam had recently started in UCD and my father was up from Trim to see how he was getting on. In the photo, my father, who was 46 at the time, is dressed in a dark three-piece suit. Liam is wearing a belted trench coat of the kind favoured by private eyes in the films of the period. But he's minus the fedora hat they usually wore. In fact, both father and son are bareheaded, in contrast to two men who appear in the shot standing outside the GPO in cloth caps and heavy overcoats, like extras in Peaky Blinders. The way that men in Europe and America abandoned their hats and caps in the second half of the 20th century is often attributed to the influence of President John F. Kennedy, who rarely wore a hat in public. Yet, judging by that photo taken on O'Connell Street, the process was underway at least a decade earlier. But, as the photograph also shows, only just. Indeed, when I was a boy, most men and women donned some kind of headgear when they left the house. It was as much a part of their appearance as wearing shoes. Women kept their hair covered at mass as well, often with a scarf or beret, until mantillas came into vogue. They also kept their fancy hats on indoors, at functions like weddings or other formal occasions. Men, on the other hand, removed their caps and hats in church. So when I was an altar boy, holding the paten under their chins at communion, I had a chance to observe how individuals rarely seen hatless looked with their heads uncovered. Bald spots and comb-overs, shaggy curls and brilled cream scalps were all on view. I remember well a farmer whose cap had engraved a demarcation line along his forehead. Below it, a weathered, leathery face. Above it, the pink, hairless dome of his head, reminiscent of an egg in a cup. One of my uncles in Trim was a postman, whose uniform included a stiff cap with green piping and a shiny peak. When he was in civvies, his choice of headwear was a soft felt hat, a term that included a variety of styles, including the trilby and fedora. The fedora has a tall indented crown and a generous brim that can be angled down over the eyes, a look that was de rigueur for detectives and tough guys in films of the 1940s and 50s. The smaller, neater trilby, with its narrow brim turned up at the back, had one of its many surges in popularity in the early 60s. When Sean Connery opens the door of Miss Moneypenny's office in the first James Bond film, Dr. No, he throws his trilby across the room and lands it on the hat rack. The scene was repeated in subsequent Bond movies with humorous variations. Given such macho associations, it's surprising to think that both the fedora and trilby were originally women's hats, which were first worn in stage plays of the late 1800s. Fedora was written for French actress Sarah Bernhardt, and when it was performed in the United States, the costumes worn by her character, Princess Fedora, inspired a range of fashion garments, including a version of her wide-brimmed hat, which was then adapted by a gentleman's hat maker. When Edward, Prince of Wales, started to wear fedoras in the 1920s, the hat became popular worldwide. In 1895, the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin was the venue for a performance of the hit melodrama Trilby, based on the best-selling novel of the same name. Set in Bohemian Paris, it tells the story of a young artist's model, Trilby O'Farrell, who falls under the spell of the sinister hypnotist Svengali. In the play, Trilby sings the song Ben Bolt, sometimes called Don't You Remember Sweet Alice? It became known as the Trilby song, just as the hat she wore on stage became known as the Trilby hat. The sentimental song has long been unfashionable, but the hat continues to hold its own, most recently as a hipster accessory. Hoodies, beanies and baseball caps may be the default headwear of the modern Irish male, but a retro style will occasionally find a niche in the market. Inspired by the TV series, the Peaky Blinders cap, with its triangular tweed panels and button on top, is having a moment right now. You could call it a case of what was old hat becoming new hat.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that, no, no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams, no, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never...
Stories, we are often taught, begin at the beginning and finish at the end, and everything in between is known as the middle. But we soon find out, of course, this isn't true. In fact, most stories begin in the middle, and by the time you've realised that they've started, chances are that they're nearly over. When this story begins, I'm in the middle of someone else's garden. In the middle of the night, in the middle of January. Earlier that evening, we had finished rehearsing a production of Ibsen's A Doll's House, and like drama students all over the world, had gone straight to the pub. When the pub had shut, we'd gone to a late opening and very unfriendly wine bar, and when they had eventually put us out, we'd gone on drinking in someone's bedsit. At about 3 in the morning, I decided that I should go home. Aware that buses were at that time infrequent, and that home was a 4-hour walk away, sensible, possibly more sober voices, attempted to get me to stay. A sofa and a sleeping bag were offered, but I was for some reason determined, and off I went. Having left the security of the house, I had gone no more than 20 yards when something in a neighbouring garden caught my eye. What could better tell our audience, I asked myself, that they had been magically transported to 19th century Oslo than a slightly stunted-looking Christmas tree? And this garden had one. I'm not proud of the impulse that came upon me, but even the most dedicated member of Neighbourhood Watch would have to admire my efficiency. In a matter of moments, I had jumped the garden wall, pulled the tree from the soil, and returned to the safety of the street. It was only as I tried to complete my getaway that I realised how heavy the tree was. I didn't quite know how I had got it this far, but there was no way I could carry it all the way back to college. And then my eyes, their powers apparently sharpened by lager, came once again to my assistance. From the far end of the road, a slight silver shimmer cut through the darkness, and an abandoned supermarket trolley announced itself. A few moments later, we were heading down the high street together, the tree and the trolley and me. It was as I was reaching around to pat myself on the back that I saw the police car. I walked on as nonchalantly as a man pushing a Christmas tree in a shopping trolley could, but I knew that both the driver and his sidekick were studying me closely. With the car approaching at no more than 10 miles an hour, I slowed down, and like the captain of the Titanic, awaited the inevitable. Perhaps I even closed my eyes. When a few moments later I opened them again, it was to see the police car drifting slowly away, past me, past the end of the road, and eventually way, way out of sight. Naturally, I was appalled. What sort of world do we live in, I asked myself, where a man who is clearly drunk can push a stolen tree in a stolen shopping trolley down a North London high street and attract no more attention than a Boy Scout on his way to church parade? The rest of my journey served to calm my outrage a little, and having parked my booty beside the college steps, I lay down on a nearby bench and went to sleep. I awoke 2 hours later to discover that it had snowed heavily. The gods were clearly sending me a message. I could not decide, however, just what the message was. Were they saying, "This is clearly a young man of courage and imagination. Let's set the tone for his production of Ibsen's classic play with a seasonal dusting of snow"? Or was it rather, "He stole a tree. Let's make him cold and wet"? Either way, I took off my coat, shook it dry as best I could, and walked over to check on last night's spoils. In the light of day, the tree was less impressive than I'd remembered. Rather than lush and green as it had seemed the night before, its branches were simply brown and dry. I saw at a glance that I had been able to pull it from the earth because it had almost no roots at all. I shook it gently, and its final handful of spines drifted quietly to the ground. Finally, it dawned on me that its owners were not growing the tree in their garden, but had rather dumped it there at the end of last Christmas, or possibly the Christmas before, hoping, perhaps, that some idiot would eventually steal it. And I had. After the excitement of the previous night, I thought it best to avoid the pub that evening, and after rehearsals planned to go straight to the station, but not until I had wheeled my trolley load of plunder out from its hiding place. I wasn't sure what to do with the tree, but I thought I should at least return the trolley to the shop around the corner. But it was not to be. Search as I might, I could find no trace of either. The morning's snow had turned to bitter slush, and the tree and the trolley were gone. In an instant, my outrage was back. In broad daylight, I complained myself, an abandoned trolley and a dead tree have been stolen. What sort of person would do such a thing? And then I remembered. I would.
Be calm. I entreat you to hear me before you give vent to your hatred. Have I not suffered enough that you seek to increase my misery? Remember that I am thy creature. I ought to be thy Adam, but I am rather the fallen angel, whom thou drivest from joy for no misdeed. Everywhere I see bliss, from which I am alone irrevocably excluded. I was benevolent and good. Misery made me a fiend. A powerful, disturbing, and resounding declaration spoken by one of world literature's most enduring figures, the ultimate outsider, an unnatural being which was created by an ambitious young Swiss scientist, Mary Shelley's doomed Victor Frankenstein. Since his publication on New Year's Day, 1818, her thrilling, highly literary, coincidental, and at times far-fetched picaresque, which pushed the Gothic conventions away from traditional horror, and closer to what would become science fiction, has continued to terrify as a depiction of consequence. Not only through its account of a deadly battle of wits between man and monster bound together, each representing two sides of the tormented human, balancing rational thought with emotional intelligence and the desire for revenge, but also, and more philosophically, because of what it reveals about man's capacity for evil, as well as the dangerous power lurking within the wrong use of silence. Mary Shelley was a teenager when she wrote it, and she had already spent many hours listening to intense intellectual dialogue. Her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, had died 11 days after giving birth to her, so Mary never knew her. But she did know her father, William Godwin, the political philosopher, a formidable individual who wrote several novels, none of which, not even the pioneering propagandist narrative Caleb Williams, has endured as well as his only child's remarkable debut. Young Mary often listened to her father and the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge in conversation. As a little girl, she had heard the poet recite The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and the poem remained vividly alive in her imagination. In the framing device opening sequences, the letters, written by Robert Walton, Frankenstein's eventual rescuer and the novel's narrator, Shelley has Walton refer to Coleridge as the most imaginative of modern poets. Coleridge's great poem, with its dramatic storytelling and ever-shifting imagery making a series of fast-moving pictures, influenced her, as did his themes of crime and punishment, culminating in damnation. There is also her use of the declamatory tone. In common with Coleridge's Mariner, her speakers share an urgent need to explain. She introduces a surreal dimension to her story. Not for nothing does the monster find comfort in gazing at the moon. Yet the essence of this book of ideas rests with Victor Frankenstein's ungodly ambition. It was the secrets of heaven and earth that I desired to learn. Whether it was the outward substance of things, of the inner spirit of nature and the mysterious soul of man that occupied me. Still, my inquiries were directed to the metaphysical, or, in its highest sense, the physical secrets of the world. Admittedly, that does not prepare anyone for his experiment to create a living creature from the body parts of corpses. Frankenstein appears to be emulating Faust in his quest for knowledge, if without making a pact with the devil. Instead, he gives life to an eloquent fiend possessed of complex sensibilities, wayward reasoning, and a deadly set of grievances. One might wonder at Walton's ability to report every word and describe every gesture. A reader may also question the monster's Shakespearean delivery. But the story based on anguish, abandonment and revenge counters any forensic argument. While the influence of Coleridge is obvious, the strongest literary presence in Frankenstein the novel is that of John Milton's Paradise Lost. The monster even describes his discovery of the verse epic. I read it, and as I read the other volumes which had fallen into my hands as a true story, it moved every feeling of wonder and awe. Like Adam, I was apparently united by no link to any other being in existence. But his state was far different from mine in every other respect. He had come forth from the hands of God, a perfect creature, happy and prosperous, but I was wretched, helpless, and alone. The monster has learned to read and speak by eavesdropping on a family of exiled French aristocrats. Their Turkish daughter-in-law is receiving language lessons from which the monster also benefits. He juxtaposes his yearnings for companionship with horrific acts of revenge. Yet Shelley succeeds in making the creature sympathetic. After all, he is a victim of a creator who immediately abandoned him. This cautionary tale, written by a teenage girl, predates Robert Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which was not published until 1886. Mary Shelley set the standard for pursuit quests and thrillers, particularly as Frankenstein and his creature circle each other, alternating the roles of hunter and hunted. Ultimately, it is the scientist, his family wiped out, who sets off across the Arctic ice to destroy the vengeful demon who has been stalking him. Only Frankenstein is thwarted and dies of exposure aboard ship, admittedly having first stunned his rescuer, Walton, the narrator, with the tale in all its convoluted entirety. The narrative structure defies all logic, the monster conveniently finding a cloak, spying on the family teaching the Turkish girl French, chancing upon copies of Paradise Lost, and Goethe's Sorrows of Young Werther, not forgetting a volume of Plutarch's Lives, and all for his reading material, apparently mastering further languages en route. But few works of fiction can claim a closing image as enduring and as heartbreakingly forlorn as that of the bereft monster, his creator dead, as he leaps down from the ship's cabin window, back onto his ice raft, upon the freezing water to cast off, soon to become, in the final words, lost in darkness and distance.
On this morning's programme, a mix of new and archive scripts, we heard Skull and Bones by Neil McArdle, Boarding School Days by Catherine Foley, Old Hat, New Hat by Patrick Dunn, The Tree, the Trolley and Me by Chris McCallum, and Journey of an Outcast by the late Eileen Battersby, the anniversary of whose death occurred over the Christmas period. The music was The Teddy Bear's Picnic by John Walter Bratton and Jimmy Kennedy, sung by the Cambridge Chord Company, conducted by Paul Davies. Children's Corner Suite, The Snow is Dancing by Debussy, played on piano by Finning Collins. The Way You Wear Your Hat by George and Ira Gershwin, sung by Frank Sinatra. And Waltz from Yoka, The Christmas Tree, by Vladimir Rebikov, played on piano by Ettore Anjaparija.